My planned topic for today was the damage done by doubt. That's what I thought I was going to do, the damage done by doubt. And I was going to intentionally ignore the good that is done by doubt so I could explore that area. I recall my father saying to me that more accidents were caused by brake pedals than by gas pedals. And I interpreted that idea as an example of the impact and the damage done by doubt. People just randomly putting their feet on the brake pedal or all of a sudden couldn't see or became uncertain and unpredictable, and they slammed the brakes on and ended up causing accidents. When I look at people who self-promote or are successful at promoting others and other products and services, there seems to be an absence of doubt. They just do it, as Nike would encourage. Holding back for the sake of holding back in self-protection is a natural survival instinct, but it's not a real reliable way of moving energy. And I think moving energy is a requirement if we want to create things and conditions in our lives. We've got to move energy. And doubt is a restriction or a holding back of that movement. But recently, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict shows me the incredible damage done by people when they have no doubts about their actions and the rightness of their causes. And I thought, you know what? Yeah, zealots and bigots and worse have no doubts that what they're doing is okay. People willing to wage war on other people have no doubt that war is the right course of action. So I started to reconsider the topic. Bertrand Russell, a British philosopher, logician, historian, mathematician, social critic, political activist, said, "The trouble with the world is that the stupid are cocksure and the intelligent are full of doubt." Pope Francis recently said, "If one has the answers to all the question, that is proof that God is not with him. The great leaders of people of God have always left room for doubt. So now, there's some benefit to doubt." And hence, my talk today has the title, Doubt: The Damage Done by Its Presence and by Its Absence. If the goal of life is spiritual growth, growth in consciousness, then what we need to do is be willing to reach out. Willing to reach out. And you would think if you had everything, you had all the answers, you knew everything the way it is and going to be and was, there would be no need to reach. That person would be like, that's it. And they would be limiting their growth because they're not open. They've got it, done that, been there, done that sort of thing. So reaching out in thought and feeling to divine consciousness and asking for enlightenment is what Christ encourages multiple times in Christ Returns Reveal Startling Truth. Also talks about understanding and experiencing the source of our being is one of the greater goals that we should all have. Just to know, understand, and experience our connection to our source of being. I think today I would say, when we have doubt, that's a sign that we should be reaching out, not retreating, not pulling back, not withdrawing. And we just need just enough certainty to take the next step, one step, not 1,000 steps, just one step. Unless, of course, we're willing to be, and this would seemed to me to be an ideal condition, to be like Walter Russell and use meditation like he did it. And what he would do is, and this is how he described it, he would go to the source of all knowledge with a question, a problem, or a thought, or a consideration, or a proposed activity. And when he was able to see the full, completed end result, then he would implement it on a physical level. But for the rest of us who haven't gotten to that level yet, where we can go into a meditation, go to the source of all knowledge, have a well-framed question or conundrum or a problem, and wait and do that enough times in order to get the completed result really clear in our imaginations, we're going to have to do it the old-fashioned way. We're going to have to learn how to trust that life is going to provide just-in-time insight, kind of like this supply system that was developed some years ago, just-in-time supply. Instead of warehousing stuff, just when you needed it in your manufacturing process, that supply would show up. It would be delivered from somebody else's warehouse, the vendor, for instance. So if we could come to terms with that and understand that this is a concept that really does exist on a spiritual level, just-in-time supply of insight, energy, resources, awareness, in order for us to take the next step, and then the next step, and then the next step, and the next step. Taking action, moving energy, is really essential to us. When I started to consider this topic, I went, as I frequently will, to thefreedictionary.com and looked up the word doubt. And it says, to be undecided or skeptical about, to tend to disbelieve, distrust, to regard as unlikely. It also says a lack of trust, a lack of certainty that often leads to irresolution. And if you really want to deal with the concept of doubt, because, like me, you also feel that this has an impact on your life and your throughput and what you're willing to be and do and have, then I would suggest that you Google on this phrase, is doubt an emotion? And you will get a whole bunch of references, a whole lot of information that you can explore. So this is clearly something that has been thought about, written about, discussed, on and on and on, by a lot of people on this planet. I'll admit, I'm not knowledgeable enough on the subject of doubt to do it complete justice, but I'm knowledgeable enough and interested enough and curious enough, and I see the value enough that I do want to explore it. I do want to reach out for a greater understanding than I currently had. It's like, that's cool. And when I was originally dealing with this, as I said earlier, I just wanted to do an analysis, if you will, or consider the damage done by doubt. And I was going to ignore completely the good that could be done by doubt. I think all emotions, by design, are for the purpose of ensuring our survival of our individuality. So you name it as an emotion, it inherently is good. It is really designed for us. And it is, of course, obvious to most people that emotions are often misapplied, and instead of ensuring our survival, they can make us more vulnerable. They can actually jeopardize our survival. And so this, when we subvert the original purpose of emotions, now we're at a disadvantage. It seemed to me that doubt is a field of energy of uncertainty, of non-definiteness. Definiteness? Try saying that a few times quickly. And so we can see doubt showing up in a situation when it appears to be unpredictable to us. We're looking at it like, what's going to happen? I don't know. Is it good or is it bad? I don't know. What we want to do is be clear and certain and as we process information and signals. And really, when we're in a situation of doubt, when the things are not definite, they're not predictable, they're not clear, then our certainty decreases, we become more uncertain, and we tend to slow down our forward progress. We tend to stop moving energy as readily as we would otherwise. Christ in the Christ Letters says that birth into the physical form brings with it the feelings of abandonment, insecurity, and loss of privacy. And each one of these will activate our ego drives to survive and to protect our individuality. And it seems to me now that if we just looked at these three items, we would go, wow, unbelievable levels of human activity are propelled by the presence of this sense of abandonment, this feeling of insecurity, this feeling of loss of privacy. And you go, So now, here I am thinking, well, if these three things, abandonment, insecurity, loss of privacy, are like checkpoints that we're going to go through mentally and emotionally before we do anything physically, like, okay, I'm considering being an astronaut. Okay, is this going to result in abandonment? Will I be loved or not loved if I undergo this, if I pursue this course of action? Will I become more or less secure? And do I have to give up privacy if I pursue that particular activity? I think that's really what happens. Of course, it happens so quickly, it's virtually overlooked by us. Like, and then we turn around and go, what are you doing? I'm procrastinating. Why? I'm not sure. And it would seem to me there is a possibility that these three concepts are at the root, but not only them. Not only them. The reason we procrastinate may be more than just those three. I could add that the needs framework that I use, SFULI plus two, survival, freedom, usefulness, love, identity, the need to be right, and the need to look good, get approval. If you added those seven items and add that to the checklist now that you've got mentally and emotionally before you undertake anything to be or to do or to have, you're like, check, 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 nope. And if we find something that feels threatening in that checklist so far, we're like, I'm not doing it. Just to make things even more complicated, let me say, I could add the four driving needs that of the ego that Christ says are displayed through the personality. Now, I've got three impulses, right? Abandonment, insecurity, loss of privacy, plus the seven needs that I described, Sapuli plus two, and the four driving needs. Now we've got 14 filters, 14 checkpoints that we instantly use to judge situations, and our movement of energy to them or away from them, our movement of ourselves as an individual to them or away from them. Are we going to bond with them or are we going to reject them? And it happens instantaneously. You go, wow, I can make it more complicated, as I'm prone to do. There's a viewpoint that says all conflicts and upsets will have one or more of these three factors: unfulfilled expectations, thwarted intentions, and undelivered or unreceived communication. So we're going to want to be something or do something or have something. So what are our expectations? Hold on. Let me go into my inventory of expectations that I have accumulated over the course of my entire life, about a gazillion, and compare this expectation, this situation, to what has happened previously. Oh, well, And my intention in this particular activity, let me compare that to the inventory of my intentions and how they worked out, or were they thwarted, were they successful, did I, you know, win the prize, or did I produce desirable results or not. And so I look at my inventory, which again is probably a gazillion different items, and it's like, ah. And then think in terms of communication, what we deliver or don't deliver, what we receive or don't receive, what others deliver or don't deliver, and others receive or don't receive. You go, got any experiences with that? You go, yes. My inventory is up in the gazillions again, and, you know, I don't know what's going to happen if I say this, nor do I know what's going to happen if I don't say that. And there we are. There we are with all of these things. So can you imagine that we're going to filter a considered idea or a considered action through 17 filters in order to make that idea or action more predictable? Are you going to take action? Hold on, I've got to go through a 17 filter checkpoint evaluation of multiple gazillions of energy patterns, and I'll give you an answer. Whew. Wow. So if we're able to predict that this action is going to be helpful to our survival, it is going to help us grow, it is going to help us be nurtured and nourished, it's going to help us heal or be protected, it's going to fulfill our needs, or it's going to help our work, it's going to help our survival, or it's going to, by doing that, it's going to help others in those same areas. So if it helps them through us, we're going to benefit in as much as the law of cause and effect is at work. We're going to reap what we sow. So if we're supporting somebody else's benefit, their self-interest, and balancing it with ours, good things are going to accrue to us. And then, if we could do that, we're going to engage in that. We're going to do that. We're going to not hesitate. We're going to have it. We'll have very, very little, if any, doubt. We're going to jump in with our energy, add our energy to this activity, and draw more to us and be successful. Easy enough. Easy enough. Unless, of course, we predict that engaging this in this activity is going to be harmful to us. And if we go through that same filtering evaluation scenario that I just described at length, you go, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing this. And then we avoid it. I actually believe that a lot of procrastination is not based upon what somebody else is going to say to us. I believe procrastination is based upon what we will say to ourselves once we get engaged in whatever project or activity that we've been trying to avoid. If we could be complimentary and encouraging and affirming and positive to ourselves while we engaged in any activity, guess what? We would engage in a lot more activities. But, yeah, I've never done that. I'm like, and what was wrong with me? Why did I get involved in that? I should have known better. I should have continued to avoid it. Maybe in weeks or months or years, somebody else will handle this. But if we have doubts, we're going to avoid doing things unless we draw more energy to us to reduce the doubt. That signal, that red light on the dashboard of our emotions, doubt, much like fear, says get more information. Consider, reconsider what your fundamental principles are about engaging in this activity. Why are we doing it? And, oh, yeah. Let me figure this out. Now, I could say, as human beings, we're not going to engage in any activity that's harmful to us. And if you thought of that for one nanosecond or less, you'd go, Tom, that's not true. That's not true. Human beings engage in tremendous number of activities that are so blatantly harmful that this balancing of survival and so on is not as clean and as pure as you're making it out to be. That's true. That's true. Human beings engage in all kinds of activities that are not good for us. So that says to me a couple of things. There is some value that people are able to extract from this particular activity that doesn't meet the eye. We look at it and go, why would a person do that? That doesn't seem to make any sense to us. But they are getting some energetic value out of it. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do it and wouldn't want to do it in the first place. Then in other cases, we could look at people smoking cigarettes and drinking a quarter of whiskey a day or driving dangerously. We say, wow, human beings have an unbelievable facility for ignoring information that's contrary to what we want to believe. We will ignore all kinds of evidence. Now, you see the politics raging about who's right in this war and who's wrong in this war and other political battles. You know, is there global warming or is there not? Are human beings having any effect on the global warming? It's like, wow. To me, it's hard that that stuff is still being debated, but human beings have a great ability to do that. But it would seem to me it's so much easier to ignore things if they're non-image and non-emotional. You add images plus emotions, those things are tremendously powerful, and they are going to influence us. So the only way to be impervious to evidence is don't get images of it, and don't let it be emotional for you. So it's almost like you're not letting this programming, you're not letting these consciousness forms penetrate your own consciousness, and you go, oh, I'm safe from that. I'm safe from that. It's like, yeah, okay. When I look at doubt, this idea of doubt is the condition of irresolution, as I said before, non-definiteness, I have to practice that word, of uncertainty, of non-specificity. In the definition of stress by Hans Selye, he said, stress is the non-specific response. Do you hear irresolution in there? Or the fact that the person is not definite? What are you going to do with that energy? I'm not definite. So it is the non-specific response to a demand placed upon the body. So we're not sure, and consequently, we don't know how to act. I find that to be a huge problem with people, and children, and maybe primarily men. I want to act, but I don't know how to act. And then we become bulls in china shops and do other things that, after the fact, we go, whoops, I wish I had a little bit more awareness. Maybe if I had a little doubt, I would have paused a teeny bit, put the foot on the brake a little bit, gotten more awareness, and then acted in a more civilized or effective way. But when we don't know how to act, and we don't know what will happen, it's like, uh-oh. That's the challenge. Anything alive is involved in moving energy themselves, and having energy move into them, through them, and out of them. Everything moves like that. And seems really clear, right, that moving energy and allowing energy for the purposes of growth, nutrition and nourishment, healing, protection, fulfillment of need, work, survival, with an understanding of rhythm. Otherwise, people get frustrated. Ah, you know, I want it to be day and it's still night, and I want it to be high tide and it's low tide. But if we understand rhythm and recognize that this applies in so many different areas of our lives, this concept of time and sequencing, we can relax a lot. And of course, the law of cause and effect. If we understand that all of that is our goal, not only for ourselves, for our families, for others, for all living things, we go, oh. But if doubt tells us to stop moving energy because we're not sure of the effects that we will cause, it's like, oh, wait a minute, that's not what it's telling me. It's telling me to evaluate the ground I'm standing on, the fundamentals, and get more information, and then continue moving. It's not stop moving energy. That's harmful. That's harmful to us. If it's momentary, no problem. But if it goes on for any length of time, we're disadvantaging ourselves. I use an energy, I describe it, my energy model of life. Some years ago, I said, what is it we're doing here? What is it we're doing? I need to understand the underlying principles. And so this is what I developed this idea, is we're involved in energy-related activities. But if we're interfering or holding back on these energy activities, we're going to be interfering with our health, our happiness, our success, our relationships. Which brought me to, we're going to acquire energy. We're going to do that. Let's face it. We're going to do it. Everybody else is going to do it. We're going to try to acquire energy. Little kids take stuff. They take toys from other little kids. Politicians and bankers take stuff from big kids. You know, we're going to acquire energy. And if we wisely acquire energy, if we wisely protect the energy that we've acquired that cannot easily be replicated or replaced, if we can replace it real easy, then protecting it is, you know, not a good use of energy. It's like, oh, the precious stuff that's irreplaceable, makes sense that we would want to protect that. And as human beings, we're going to want to do that. Animals do the same thing. They're going to protect their territories. They're going to protect their food. They're going to protect their offspring. They do it. We do it. So, oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. That's part of life. Exactly. We have the opportunity to translate energy in infinite number of ways. Whereas, say, my avocado tree or lemon tree or an apple tree pretty much is limited in how it can express its consciousness. They're going to produce avocados, lemons, and apples. I got that. You get that. But human beings, the fruit that we can produce, essentially unlimited in terms of the forms of expression. And if we wisely translate that energy and we wisely express that, if we express that energy in our activities, the way we think, feel, speak, and act, the things that we want to create, contribute to. And one of the challenges for lots of people is to wisely release the energies that we can no longer use. Or we release them because we can't get any more value from them. You can think of the food that we eat. When you can't get any more nutritional value from it, you definitely want to let it go. And this is the same thing of clothing or other objects, material objects, that seem to have lost their value to you or to us, then we go like, maybe they will have value to somebody else, Goodwill, St. Francis de Paul, or other charities. Like this whole idea that one person's trash is another person's treasure says that I may not be able to get value out of it, but that doesn't mean there's no value there. It's I just can't get more value out of that. And oftentimes that's just a viewpoint. No, I have a different decor now, so that item doesn't fit into my environment, and somebody else can get value for it. And then, after we release, if we seek closure, I would say that closure at the end of a cycle is some sort of feeling of satisfaction. You know what? I've done the best I could based upon what I knew at that time. Very easy on Monday to judge Sunday's activities. Oh, I should have done that. Oh, I should have ordered that in a restaurant. Oh, I shouldn't have thrown that interception when I was playing football. Easy to do on Monday. But we need to get to the point where I did the best I could at that time. I tried to be as effective as I could at that time, and I'm okay with that. And when we get to that place that we've ended the cycle, it's a nice clean sense of closure, and we can use that power to encourage us to repeat the sequence, because to me, everything is a sequence. Acquiring energy, protecting the energy, translating the energy, expressing the energy, releasing what we can't use any longer, and getting a sense of closure. And then we're going to do it again, and again, and again, and again, and again. If we could do that, just like I described, and get that sense of closure, I think we would accomplish great things for ourselves, for our families, and for others. When we're not able, and I recently had a conversation with a person who never could arrive at closure when he was a kid. When he was done with something, his parents made him continue, even though he was done. And so, you completed that job, you finished your homework, you cleaned up your room, then is it, you never got an attaboy, you never got any, nope, couldn't go out and play, couldn't do this, couldn't do that, had to just sit there and do more of it. Now, I would guess that the parents were thinking, this is a way to help a child to develop. If the more homework they do, they're going to be smarter and ultimately going to get a job and live happily ever after. However, if you can't get satisfaction from an activity, how do you know that an activity is going to produce satisfaction for you? I'm about to engage in an activity. I got a lot of doubt. Well, you know, you're going to get some satisfaction. I don't even know what that word means. I never got satisfaction from doing an activity. Like, oh boy. You know, when you feel good, you did a good job, or never had that sense. Never had that sense. No pat on the back, no attaboy, no encouragement, no gold star, no reward, no little trophy, no none of that. You go, wow. And if we've had lives loaded with experiences like that, where there has been no closure that resulted in our satisfaction, that empowers us to do the sequence again, we're going to be dealing, contending with a huge amount of doubt. Basically, like, what's the point? Why am I doing this? Why do I only do activities that never produce any emotional, spiritual, mental reward? Like, poor training. Should have been able to learn how to get to that place. Finish a cycle with a rewarding end that empowers us to continue with the next cycle and the next and the next. I was wondering if the solution to doubt is to get greater awareness before we do things. I just had a conversation a little while ago with friends. This thought has been on my mind for more than a week. I want to know a lot of stuff, and I'll bet you do too. I want to know a lot of stuff, but I can't sit down and read a 400-page book every time I want to know something about anything. I just saw a book in my friend's house, The Weeds of the Northeast. You know, several hundred page book about weeds in the Northeast. And I said, you know what? You know what? I believe, this is my belief, that everything we need for complete health already exists. We just have to discover it. So weeds, to include cannabis, those things, they already exist. They're God-designed gifts. They exist in the woods, in the lawn, in the, you name it. But if we don't know what value those weeds have, then we don't use them for teas and poultices and lotions and whatever else we could use them for. But if we knew there was some medicinal health and healing value to those weeds, it would be great for us. But of course, the dilemma is, if you can't patent those things, drug companies are not interested in dealing with them. It's only stuff that's patentable. And that way they can control the manufacturing and make money from it, pay for the trials that will be necessary, and there is an enormous amount of expense involved in that. But if you think, God has got things out there to reduce human suffering, but I'm not willing to read that entire book. So I said to my friends, this is a thought that's been on my mind recently. In order to eliminate a lot of doubt, this is what I want to know. What are the 5 main principles regarding fill in the blank, or the 10 main principles fill in the blank, or the, if I'm really interested in this topic, the 100 main principles? If I could get that kind of information, then I would go, oh, you know what, I want to know more about this, or nope, that's all I need. So I said to them, we were talking about boats, and I said, you know what, I would like to know the 5 main principles of kayaking. Got a son, he just said, it's the greatest thing going. What are the 5 main principles? And they both looked at me, husband and wife, go, we have 2 kayaks. I said, okay, so what are the 5 main principles? They go, I don't know, because we've never used our kayaks. I said, oh, why not? The thought to me, in my own mind, is because they doubt that the outcome of a kayaking activity is going to produce results that they're going to find desirable. I want to know the 5 principles or more that are going to make my engagement with a kayak enjoyable, desirable, fun, meaningful to me. And say, well, we don't really know. And then Patty, the wife, said, well, you know, the oars have to be sized for how high or low you sit in the kayak, and they have to be a certain length based upon your arm length and shoulder span, and so, oh, well, maybe there were 5 principles having to do with the fit of a kayak. And by looking for these principles, by reaching out for these principles, I think we can eliminate a lot of doubt about, you name it, anything, cooking something or painting something or drawing something or any number of things. I thought, that's cool. I really like it. The idea of reaching out for greater awareness in bite size rather than a 400-page manual is going to be much more acceptable and convenient for most of us. But that's really cool. If our doubt or our fear of criticism, you know, the first driving need that Christ talks about, that defending ourselves from criticism or emotional or physical attack, if those things are enormously strong because of past experience, another gazillion images in our inventory of being criticized or attacked emotionally or physically, we're going to have a great deal of difficulty moving forward through this field of doubt in order to engage in activities. We're going to be handicapped. I'd like to go back and say, because Christ talks about meditation being so important, we can be like Walter Russell. We can take the questions, we can take our situations, we can take the ideas that we want to know more about into meditation to the source of all knowledge, get clarity about that project. And when we get that clarity, we know what to do on a physical level next. We can do that. And we would have banished the control over us of doubt. And then we would continue growing because we would choose to reach out. Now that we know that doubt inspires us to reach out and grow, it is not a bad thing. It doesn't damage us. It helps us continue to grow. I would like to end this service with a prayer. This is the pluralized version of the prayer from Letter 8 in Christ Returns, Reveals Startling Truth. Father, Mother, Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know it is your will that we shall be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know that you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness. And as we listen, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen. If you want to hit start.